not so much based on fact, but by a certain kind of, cocksuredness, uncertainty of the virtues of the form of capitalism we have now. They respond with these kind of reviews, these kind of dismissive reviews.
We've been speaking with Greg Grandin, author of The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and Deception in the New World. His piece, The Economist's Slavery Problem, is in the new edition of The Nation. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Greg Grandin.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 6 o'clock, and coming up next, it's Bread and Roses, Feminist News and Public Affairs. That's coming up on KBOO Community Radio. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the release party for the Sexbot's new EP, Songs for Jamil, at Dante's on Sunday, September 14th at 9 p.m. Dante's is a 21 and over venue. The Sexbots are a provocative, experimental electronic art pop act based in Portland who have a strong performance art component. Again, that's the release party for the Sexbots' new EP, Songs for Jamil, at Dante's, 350 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle Productions premiere of Tick, Tick, Boom, a play by Jonathan Larson. Tick, Tick, Boom is a three-chapter pop-rock musical about facing crossroads in life and holding on to your dreams that was first produced off-Broadway in 2001. Tick, Tick, Boom plays at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland, from September 4th through the 27th. More information about Tick, Tick, Boom can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
To Bread and Roses. I'm your host, Delphine Crescenzo. Bread and Roses is a collective of women-identified radio activists bringing you feminist news and public affairs programming every Friday at 6 p.m. That's here on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM. Women have had this forum on KBOO since 1978. That's 35 years. We always welcome new collective members, so if you would like to host, produce, or engineer with us, you can contact KBOO's volunteer manager. Her email is volunteer@kboo.org. You can also find us on the web, kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can listen to past shows, share comments, or show ideas. And of course, we are on Facebook. KBOO Bread and Roses is where you can like us. Tonight on Bread and Roses, we say Black Lives Matter. In the aftermath of the murder of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, by police officer Darren Wilson, protests have been taking place all over the country against police violence and racial discrimination. A strong message has emerged from this movement that the lives of Black people do matter. A controversy started after the death of Michael Brown over the way he was being described in the media in a video released by the police of someone suspected to be Michael Brown stealing from a corner store. There are no excuses that can justify the murder of Michael Brown. His life mattered. As the city council met a few days ago in Ferguson, Missouri, to address some of the local systemic issues that resulted in the death of Michael Brown and the response of the Black community to his murder, we welcome tonight on Bread and Roses two Portland community activists who traveled to Ferguson, Missouri, August 28th to September 1st, on the Black Lives Matters Ride, an initiative to bring Black folks from across the country into Ferguson, Missouri, as part of a national call to end state violence against Black people. We welcome to the studio to Sarah Dutley, a senior at PSU, majoring in Black Studies. With experience in local government and nonprofit organizing, Tessera is passionate about creating a more equitable world through advocacy and action. We also welcome with us Stephen Gilliam. Since moving to Portland in 2008, Stephen has been a community activist, most recently as a volunteer for the African American Leadership Academy. He went to Ferguson to support the community in their fight against institutional racism. Welcome, both of you, to Bread and Roses, and welcome back to Sarah.
Yeah.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yeah. I'd like to start the conversation by getting your reaction to the murder of Michael Brown. What was initially your reaction?
Well, I think I was already not having a good day when that happened. Just I'd been online and things were going on. Mm. There was actually someone got assaulted on the Max near my house, and I was about to ride the Max, so I was kind of worried about what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And while I was riding the Max, I went on Twitter to see if I could figure out what was going on with the police and the mm-hmm. Max. And I saw this other thing happening, which was the immediate aftermath of the shooting and the roll-in of police and dogs, and they brought tear gas and mm-hmm. vehicles full of people in riot gear, and just folks were taking pictures and talking about what was going on, and it was so scary, but it was also really far away. Like, I felt very ineffectual. Mm-hmm. Didn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Stephen?
So I got the news. I was coming back from a trip, and someone sent me a text message and said, look up Ferguson, Missouri. Mm. And when I got through on my phone and Googled it and I started reading about it, I was honestly, I was kind of just in a state of shock. And I was just like, oh, again, you know, this type of violence against the Black community by police officers happens all the time, everywhere. And I was, you know, numb to it. I think we're all numb to it in a certain extent because a Michael Brown happens twice a week. Mm. And I kind of, you know, talked about it with my partner as we were driving back for a little while, and then forgot about it until I turned on the news and I saw the reaction that Tessera alluded to. And I was like, oh no, like this is, not only is this going to be a Black violence issue, but this is like a police state issue. Mm-hmm. And it's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And then just got, you know, hooked and could not stop talking about it with people, and really felt bad for the community that was obviously in a state of shock, and obviously in trauma, and obviously had a lot going on and a lot being done to it.
Hmm. Why, in your guys' opinion, was the murder of Barker Mountain, what did it trigger such a huge reaction around police violence and racial discrimination?
I think part of it is folks have been talking about the fact that Ferguson is off, it's part of St. Louis County. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a suburb in that sense, and that it's a suburb that doesn't have a lot of violence in it. Mm. And really, folks have mentioned that this was the first murder in Ferguson in 2014.
Wow.
So Michael Brown being shot by a police officer in his own neighborhood was the first murder that occurred in Ferguson in 2014, and that was shocking. And then the fact that before anyone had really started to react more than shock, the fact that the local police rolled in as though a riot were going to happen provoked a reaction, I think. It just treating people like they didn't matter and as though they were going to react with violence, mm-hmm. and using tear gas and mm-hmm. things to quell violence caused violence. And it didn't stop. It was definitely, like Stephen mentioned, this police state issue. The fact that they went in as though it were a war zone mm-hmm. and just kept going for days and days has really kept it, it's kept it at that high level of violence and visibility. So many people went, and unfortunately a lot of journalists went and behaved kind of badly, trying to get a story. But it also, having such a high degree of that visibility, kept it in the national eye for longer and became a flashpoint that folks could organize around.
Can you explain what you mean by some journalists went down there acting badly trying to get a story?
I just read pieces by a couple different journalists who mm-hmm. said that they had seen other journalists mm-hmm. doing things like blocking off areas that could have been used as shelters from tear gas so that they could get a good spot to put their camera.
Of folks running away from the tear gas.
Folks climbing up on cars uh-huh. to get shots of folks running away from mm-hmm. tear gas and mm-hmm. from the police, or being surrounded by... there was a woman who had been helping people by getting milk on their faces when they'd been tear gassed, and she herself was tear gassed later on in the evening. And there's a picture someone else took, someone took from further back, of her surrounded by journalists. There were folks all around her while other people were trying to get in and get her aid.
Mm-hmm.
And just because that was the story, mm-hmm. They did some things that actually added to the problem.
Yeah, so it's kind of like getting the picture first before helping the dying child, which has happened often.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to add, Stephen, to what, in your opinion, triggered such a huge response, right? As you say, there's a Michael Brown, you know, twice a week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, I hesitate to really answer that because I don't know why the national media decides to sensationalize. It probably, you know, cynically speaking, it probably has to do with the fact that there was video. And that the tactic that the community used to try and mitigate the violent response from the police was video and a lot of pictures. Mm-hmm. And I think that during that news cycle, that was the most exciting, quote unquote, thing. Also, when we were down in Ferguson, you know, talking to a lot of the activists and community members down there, they were really upset behind the framing of the incident and the kind of fetishization of violence, right? The violence and the rioting is the big story. During one of the quote-unquote riots, there was a peaceful sit-in at the police station, and there was cameras there, and they left because they heard someone was breaking windows. We were talking with some of the shop owners along that strip that was all boarded up, and they're like, these are the people that rob us anyway. They just had a free night because the police were busy elsewhere. They were very supportive of the community. They were very supportive of the protesters. They marched with us on Saturday. But the way the media portrayed it is like, oh, this is a real issue with the black community. They're so angry and uncontrollable and reactionary. And it was, you know, for me, that was really kind of infuriating to just continue to see that media, you know, trope just get repeated over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one thing that's interesting is that even now, stories about it emphasize rioting and looting.
When the real story is the murder,
and the real story is the murder, but there are also photos that came out as protests were happening of locals who were stopping folks from looting in the shops. Like, those photos exist. There are a lot of them because that was what was happening. And still you see every story they open with, you know, the recent unrest with rioting and looting and the police response and all of that, but they open with that sort of look at this black community rioting and stealing things.
Yeah.
As usual.
Yeah, and I think for me also something that I just want to mention is the fact that Michael Brown's body just laid uncovered, bleeding on the ground for hours after he was shot. And this is, you know, in my opinion, that you know, something nobody, you know, should have to go through that. There was just no reason for him to be there.
Yeah.
And so as a response, there was a huge movement and a hashtag. Nothing happens without a hashtag anymore. Black Lives Matter. Can you talk about that movement and the significance of the phrase?
Well, I think I might have got plugged in a little bit later. I know there was organizing here before I really sort of jumped in a week before the ride happened. I wasn't on the national calls, but the conversation for me around the hashtag Black Lives Matter and just the concept itself is something I recently tweeted about. Antonio French is St. Louis alderman, and he was heavily involved. He's been tweeting and posting photos, and an activist on the Black Lives Matter ride went and met him actually at a protest there and tweeted it with the hashtag Black Lives Matter, and two people came in to get really upset and respond with All Lives Matter, don't make it about black people. And we're like, well, this is about black people. And for me, when the reason that Black Lives Matter is the touch point there is that black people are playing catch up in the sense that for various historical reasons, black lives have been valued less for a very long time. And unfortunately, that leaves us in the position of having to start at the baseline, which is that we are also people and we count instead of, you know, you can't do this to people. It's we're people and you can't do this to people. And really, it's hard to do those comparisons like, well, if it was white people, it would be like this and that. But this situation happened because it happens all the time, because there is that every 28 hours a black person is shot in the United States, that there are two Mike Browns a week, things like that. This is kind of the norm. And so we're pushing back against the idea that that should be the norm. We're pointing at it and saying this isn't okay, because really at the heart of it is that black people need to catch up to the rest of everyone else in terms of being valued in human life.
Yeah, because very quickly also there was conversations of, you know, he was a good kid, he was going to college. That does not really have anything to do with this. I mean, yes, it's a lost life, and it's, you know, maybe our next president that we will never know because he was shot by the police, but that doesn't have anything. That shouldn't be the reason why his life mattered.
Yeah, we stopped executing people for shoplifting hundreds of years ago.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, Delphine, because, you know, immediately after there was reactions to the police presence and the protesters' tactics. But I think the one thing that was going to Michael Brown was about his character. Mm-hmm. And if he was good enough, he was a good, you know, black guy because he went to college, and mm-hmm. he was a good black guy because his mom loved him. But he was bad because he stole some cigarillos and he was walking in the streets and like listens to rap music. I don't know, whatever the craziness we're saying.
Was that video ever actually, did they ever identify actually that that was really him?
I'm not sure.
So my understanding is that it was Michael Brown, but that they cut 5 minutes out of the middle.
Okay.
So there are 5 minutes in the middle of that video where he paid for them. And he didn't have enough money for all of the ones he wanted, so he left some on the counter. Oh, and when he went to leave, the shop owner came around to talk to him. And they had an argument of some kind, mm-hmm. but it was resolved peacefully. The shop owner left and back to the counter and never called the police. Mm-hmm. And then when they released the tape, they had cut out a chunk of it to make him look bad.
Mm. I apologize. I'm just laughing. It's not funny at all. But the fact that they cut 5 minutes of the tape is what made me giggle. Just happened
audacious.
Too often. Yeah, right.
It's pretty
and obvious. I had not heard that. So thank you. Thank you for that piece of information. You're listening to Bread and Roses. When we come back, I'd love to talk about you guys organizing the ride and actually going to Ferguson. We are talking this evening on Bread and Roses about the Black Lives Matter ride. With two community organizers who actually went there, Tessera Dudley and Steven Gilliam. So we're going to take a short musical break, and this is Lauryn Hill, Black Rage, I think a wonderful song that somewhat exemplifies some of this historical disenfranchisement that you were talking about, Tessera, earlier. So this is Bread and Roses. We'll be back in just a minute.
On two-thirds a person, rapings and beatings and suffering that worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on blatant denial, squeezed economics, subsistence survival, deafening silence and social control. Black rage is found in all wounds in the soul. When the dogs bite, when the bees sting, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I don't fear so. Black rage is founded, fed us self-hatred, lies and abuse while we waited and waited. Spiritual treason, this grid and its cages. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things. Black rage is founded.
Progress of human contortion. You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. I'm joined in the studio by Tessera Dudley and Stephen Gilliam. And we are talking about the Black Lives Matter ride that they actually helped organize in to go to Ferguson for people around here, right? It was Oregon and in Washington State. So could you talk about that a little bit? What was the national call and how did you guys end up working it out here in the Northwest area?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier that I got involved slightly later. What I saw was that folks had created a couple of Facebook events for the ride, and I had been trying to work out a way to get there on my own for a little while. Actually, about a week in, I started talking about that. And I'm friends with one of the local organizers who we were communicating, and she said to me, I'd really like you to join the leadership team if you want to get involved. And so we pulled together really fast. In fact, I think we went from like a Thursday, Friday to the next Thursday when we left Portland. And it was kind of frenetic getting everything pulled together in about a week, but we did manage it. I was mainly involved in some of the logistics work with booking hotels, and I did a lot of fundraising, and so paying for things and making sure folks, because I was working on social media, so I was working on the Facebook group, and I created a graphic that was used in the promo for this show to let folks know the hashtag that I was going to be using when I was tweeting from there. And so I did some social media work and made sure folks who wanted to be involved could be involved. I also collected a lot of donations. So we took school supplies, we took deodorant, soap, you know,
Diapers,
yeah. Things like that.
Things that you thought people food. On the ground would need.
We saw a couple of specific calls. Okay. So I had heard a call for school supplies a week before, and I checked in with some folks, and they were like, yes, also deodorant, soap, things like that, and food.
So that's what you guys took down there.
Yeah, as Tessara said, it was really hectic. I got involved because I was talking about it with my friend from St. Louis, and my partner said, you should go to Ferguson. I know someone that's organizing a trip, and they were in L.A., and there was a small group of organizers. One was in New York, one was in L.A., and they were just kind of spread around the country, and it went from, oh, yeah, we have an idea to go to Ferguson, to, okay, you need to get a van quote, plan your route, and get your gas money ready in about 48 hours. So it was really hectic, but it was really amazing that, you know, we had a lot of people that volunteered a lot of their time to work out a lot of logistics. We had people that helped fundraise and plan and were on calls for hours and hours that didn't even go on the trip. And they just did it to help other people go. And that was really, you know, amazing. And it was just really cool to see a bunch of people come together to kind of answer this national call for action and solidarity and unity to end state-sanctioned Black violence.
What was it important for you to go?
Well, so I had originally been talking about going with my partner, who's white, and we came together under the banner of Black Lives Matter. And at that point, my partner decided to pull back. We were hearing a call from some of the national level organizers that this was to be a predominantly Black space, which I think makes sense. It was really about allowing and helping Black people to take leadership roles, to be involved very heavily in this in a way that was, for us, expressing our humanity and our solidarity across the nation. And while having folks who were not Black provide support, it was also about coming together as a community.
Stephen, why did you go?
I wanted to show unity and answer their call. You know, I talked to a couple people that I knew on the ground, and they wanted support to help maintain the momentum so they could get their demands met. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanted things like the prosecutor to be removed, mm-hmm. Darren Wilson, the officer that shot Michael Brown. They wanted him arrested and charged with murder. And they were facing a lot of oppression by the police force, you know, and they needed people to be there to support them physically as a physical presence. So that's why I wanted to go.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I do have the demands here. So there is the justice for the family of Michael Brown. Also, the development of a national policy specifically aimed at redressing that anti-black law enforcement violence that's, you know, all across the U.S. Demilitarization also law enforcement, which I'd love for us to talk about a little bit. The release of the names of all the officers that were involved in murdering black people, both on patrol and also inside custody from the last 5 years onward, right? Like, that really shows a systemic problem. Mm-hmm. And the decrease of law enforcement spending and budget. There was this huge controversy that came out around how some of the police is being funded through those warrants and things like that. So these were some of the demands. I'd love to talk a little bit about the fact that the ride was for black folks to go. Why was it essential for that place to be held for black people to go?
Well, I think that, you know, that was essential because the people that are primarily affected by the problem need to be first and foremost when trying to develop a solution or to fight back. We had very, very, very limited resources. When we decided to go, we had $0. and it's 30 hours. If you drove your car straight to Ferguson, Missouri from Portland, it's 30 hours. Yeah. So we couldn't let everyone that wanted to come. And we prioritized black people because we are primarily affected by this violence.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to?
I think when we when we talk about issues of race and racism, it's often that white folks hear that best from other white folks. Mm-hmm. But we want to be prioritizing and emphasizing the voices of folks who experience racism first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And that has looked in some places like taking the words of black people and using them without crediting anyone or crediting very grudgingly. Instead of amplifying the voices mm-hmm. of black people, it ends up being white people taking credit for mm-hmm. what black people have been saying for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And we really wanted to make sure that this is a space where the folks in leadership were black people, because this really is like our daily realities and our lives and people in our communities and our relatives. And it's really what we know it because we live it.
Mm-hmm. I heard also some folks actually talking about how important it was to shift the representation, right? So that if, you know, instead of that, you know, black folks are just rioting, angry, if instead, you know, they saw just like, you know, black leaders all around in the streets, you know, that they will be faced with the reality that, in fact, you know, what they've been reporting on is just not simply true. You know, the black community is also, you know, all these other things. Right.
I don't think I felt that need. I feel like Black Rage is legitimate, mm-hmm. Especially after talking to the people that are there and what they were facing. Mm-hmm. This violence was not initiated by black people, mm-hmm. whether it be against property or against people. I didn't really feel the need to show that we can peacefully protest, or we can be here and stand in solidarity. Mm-hmm. I think everyone in that community experiencing that type of oppression is free to do what they choose. And I don't think that it is our job to decide what image they need to portray and then help them portray it. I think it's our job to be at their disposal.
Yeah.
Very well said.
I think that plays a lot into the idea of like respectability politics, mm-hmm. and the idea of things only being legitimate or valuable when they're calm and when they're rational and when they're presented with a very professional face. And that's often used to shut down conversations or devalue the words of folks experiencing oppression. Mm-hmm. The idea that your humanity is only valuable as long as you can defend it calmly is a very demeaning one. I also didn't have the consideration of going there as a calm or rational face, or a face that was not involved in rioting and looting, because I... Playing for respectability is a no-win game. Mm-hmm. No matter how respectable we are, the system is set up to
fail,
to just deny us constantly. And we saw that in the immediate aftermath. Folks started talking about Michael Brown was going to college and he had graduated and all of these things. And immediately, the attempt began to pick out the little tiny things that people could find that made him not respectable enough. But also, if you think about the fact that Henry Gates Jr. Mm-hmm. was arrested outside of his own home, like he's a professor.
In Cambridge.
He's a professor. He's very well known and very respectable, if you will. And even his respectability never mm-hmm. saved him, because first and foremost, he mm-hmm. is seen as Black.
Yeah, and so he was arrested, actually, in fact, breaking into his own home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Yeah. Thank you very much, both of you, for this perspective. I'd love to talk about what you guys witnessed on the ground. What were you expecting it would be, And what was it like?
So I wasn't really sure what to expect when we were going down. There was a lot going on over here, and I didn't have my ear to the ground as much as I did in the earlier days. But when we got there, it was surprising how much and how hard it would be to know what's happening unless you were directly there in that small section of North St. Louis, just because it's hard to get media to report on things other than, you know, what they want to.
Yeah.
They're, you know, obviously not objective, and they're all pushing their storylines that they think is it. And so just speaking with people was really informative to me, speaking with youth leaders, just people in the community. One woman was like, wow, it feels so good to have y'all just here, like backing us up. It's like, I've been out here for 3 days and there was only, you know, 25 or 30 mm-hmm. people. And we did a demonstration outside of the police station and there was probably 500. And she was like, this was awesome. I'm so glad. I didn't know that anything could ever change, but I really have hope that it will. So it was really, hard, but, uplifting to see so many people come from so many different places, unified and supportive of each other.
Yeah. I think, sorry. I think what I really valued for me, but also found frustrating, was the stories that were getting told.
Mm-hmm.
On the last day, there was this larger community discussion session where folks from the community got to express their stories to the activists and in general and share that. And afterwards, I spoke with this woman who was an assistant teacher at Michael Brown's school, which is being dismantled. So the school All those students were being shuffled off to different schools, and folks had to, they all lost their jobs and had to reapply for new jobs.
Wow.
Many of them for lower pay. And that it was really demoralizing to the students in leading up to their graduation. And some just dropped out, like getting mm-hmm. folks to graduate because they were, like, there were, their community was being disbanded mm-hmm. And things were beginning to shift. And so she was really heartbroken about Michael Brown's death because the community was being shifted and changed, and that it had been so hard to get folks from that graduating class to graduate. And then almost immediately this happened, and she expressed that she was glad that we had come. She wanted to see young people taking the leadership, and she felt like young people were really going to lead a change. And these are the stories that aren't getting told.
Yeah.
When we read the news, and I guess not we, because I don't read the news about Ferguson. I'm on Twitter, where most folks are really sharing the stories
yeah.
and sharing what's going on. When things get reported, we don't hear the stories of everyday people who have been watching this unfold in their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I've forgotten the question.
Yeah, and how that impacts them, right, personally. I mean, the question is just about your experience. I think this is so crucial that I'm hearing from both of you guys that what the media is putting out there is, yeah, maybe a part of the story, pieces of it, even though some of the reporting is very slanted, right? Mm-hmm. With reporters waiting for those action shots, right, of riots, etc. But then there's also another story that I heard, which was, well, school is actually not going on, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was like in the first few weeks, there was like schools was actually closed. Mm-hmm. So on top of being victimized in this way, in losing one of their community member and all the suffering that goes through that, also people are being further disenfranchised by, you know, a state of emergency, you know, so therefore we're going to close the schools.
One of the beautiful things was also seeing the resilience and the resourcefulness mm-hmm. that came out of that. So teachers and librarians organized to hold school sort of informally in libraries just to make sure folks had a place to go, and also that anyone who was normally a recipient of free or reduced price mm-hmm. lunch and breakfast, like I was when I was a kid, mm-hmm. I also had that, and folks who never had that don't realize how much you can rely on yeah. it. They organized food drives and took food donations so they could feed children during the day while mm-hmm. their parents had to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so people really pulled together, and there was also, I saw a lot of that. It was hard that this was sort of the catalyst for it. Mm-hmm. It's hard to think about the fact that folks had to do that work, but it was interesting that lives are going on, mm-hmm. even while going through things like
mm-hmm.
this.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Bread and Roses. We're going to take a short musical break. We are talking with Tessera and Stephen, who both are Portland community activists and both traveled to Ferguson, Missouri a couple weeks ago. You know, kind of sharing with us information that you can only get if you're on the ground, right? So we're going to listen to Angie Stone. This is Black Brother, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Is my king, is my one. Yes, he's my father, yes, he's my son. I can talk to him, cause he understands everything I go through and everything I am. He's my support system, I can't live without him. The best thing since sliced bread is his kiss, his hugs, his lips, his touch. And I just want the whole world to know about my black brother. I love you, and I'll never try
to hurt you. I want you to know that I'm here for you forever true. Cause you're my black brother, strong brother, and there is no one above you. I want you to know that I'm here for you forever true.
He's misunderstood. Some say that he's up to no good around the neighborhood. Well, for your information, a lot of my brothers got education. Now check it. You got your Wall Street brother, your blue collar brother, your down for whatever, chilling on the corner brother, your talented brother. And to every one of y'all behind bars, you know that Angie loves you. But my black brother, no, 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 no.
I want you to know that I'm here for you forever true. Cause you're my brother, strong whoa, brother, whoa, whoa. There is no one above you.
That was Angie Stone, and tonight we are talking with two community, Portland community activists, Stephen Gilliam and Tessera Dudley, and they both traveled to Ferguson, Missouri a couple weeks ago. Before the break, we were talking about what you guys experienced. Thank you for sharing those very important pieces that are now being reported back to us. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you actually did while you were down there.
Okay, so I'd say most people arrived Friday evening or early Saturday morning. On Friday, Tessera and I went to the church that was kind of our home base for our time there, and we met with people that were coming in, and we also met with people from Organization for a Black Struggle, kind of just talked and got to know people. On Saturday, there was a march that went to the site where Michael Brown was killed. And from there, we came back up to the block and marched through a horrendous rainstorm up a hill. And it kind of got interesting at that point because there was young people leading the march that have a different kind of analysis on the situation and are willing to go to further extremes to get what they want. And then there is kind of like the national Al Sharpton type people, and literally Al Sharpton, that are kind of using this in a way to boost up their personal organizations. Mm-hmm. So the march went by a park, and I would say the people that have that are in organizations tried to go to a bandstand and have a rally. Whereas the people that were living in the community, that they wanted to go to the police station and hold a demonstration outside the police station and continue to advocate for the demands. And after we get to the bandstand, they were like, okay, they were in the back ready to go to the police station. And after about 30 seconds, they just started a chant. They were going, police station, police station. And I don't think it was in the organizers of the bandstand group's original plan to go to the police station, but they had to eventually say, okay, we're going to the police station.
But first we're going to talk.
But first we're going to talk for what seemed like it was going to be hours. So eventually groups just started breaking off and going to the police station anyway. I went to the police station and we were there for about, I don't know, 4.5 hours, 5 hours at least. It seemed like all day. And the group was ready to shut down, you know, business in the downtown, shut down whatever was happening until they were heard. Mm-hmm. And they were doing nonviolent civil disobedience in a very confrontational way. And they were okay with that. And it was interesting to see, you know, the National Action Network saying, everybody go home and register to vote and then come back. And, you know, it was just really weird to watch that dynamic play out.
Hmm. Yeah. We arrived kind of early. We got in on Thursday because we flew, which made actually logistics a little bit easier because we could check into the hotel rooms for before the ride got there. And they, our riders got in kind of late. They got at four in the morning.
Yeah, so good
Saturday morning. Weather. And I have never tried to navigate checking into a hotel at 4 a.m. I don't know what that would have looked
like. After a 30-hour ride in a bus.
And we were there early. We there was a little bit of sort of meeting on Friday to talk about the general plan for the weekend. I designed a flyer while we were waiting for folks to ride in that was used the next day. So there was a march Saturday morning, and the plan had been initially to come back, but that fragmented a little bit. Some folks went to the police station to protest, and then there was a community barbecue held by community members to really get to know folks and share, and a plan to send groups to canvas in the prosecutor McCullough's neighborhood, and that was what the flyer was for. So we had a half sheet, and folks were handing it out in McCullough's neighborhood to really encourage neighbors to step in and put pressure to ask McCullough to recuse himself, and he's since refused to do that, and the governor has said that he's not going to ask for that. If McCullough wants to recuse himself, that's fine. Yeah. There's all that sort of thing going on. But folks did a lot of community engagement and, like, listening to what folks wanted. We were there to support people in the community, so that's what we did. And Saturday, there was community healing, or Sunday, rather, there was community healing, story sharing, and planning for how to keep the movement going. And it was really, it felt like a lot of an amazing space to just see the energy being built towards creating real change.
There's been a lot of talk about the militarization of the police in Ferguson as a follow-up of those events. In fact, they had all that stuff like packed away. They were like ready just in case this is coming. Did you guys witness any of that? Was there some tanks, etc.?
Not in Ferguson. I think they were on their best behavior.
Okay.
I've witnessed it more in Portland than we saw in Ferguson, I think.
Wow.
We got there after they packed everything away. They also managed to get body cameras to deploy on the march. So they were like, look at us. We finally have those body cameras you've been asking us for. See, we're doing so good. We're very respectful. We would never hurt any of you.
Yeah, I think the video thing is something that seems to be you know, very important. Want to say, unfortunately, because I think that the testimony of people should be enough, but it seems that, you know, being able to saw it recently with the NFL player.
Can I speak to that video a little bit?
Absolutely.
So a lot of the video stuff is interesting when you think about it, the way that it's so so quickly been reformed, kind of, right? Portland police are like, oh, yeah, we'll do that. And Ferguson had it donated by the company. And, you know, just talking with some people on the ground there and some community advocates here in Portland, people are really worried about targeting. So in Ferguson, there's three warrants, I believe, for every household. And they largely fund a good portion of their government off of taxes and fees made by court costs and stuff like that. Yeah. Then we have the prison industrial complex, which makes money off of getting people in jail. And people are really worried about the body cameras being used to, in conjunction with facial recognition software, to really target people really more effectively and feed people into this correctional system that we have that's really for profit and oppression. So I think a lot of people can put two and two together, and just on the surface, the body cameras seem like a really bad, a good idea. But I think when you dig into it a little bit more, I think it's a really bad idea. Mm-hmm. I think the issue is more that we need to value Black people's lives, not be scared of them, and maybe not have ridiculous tanks and guns and shoot first and do stuff like that, rather than saying, oh, if we only have cameras, we'll behave. Because, you know, even in places that do have cameras, they mysteriously stop working sometimes. Yeah. So
or they being edited 5 minutes out.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So I think this idea that technology is going to save us from racism is just like saying it's going to save us from global warming or anything like that. It's our behavior that needs to change.
Yeah, or domestic violence.
There was a national call on Tuesday, and some folks on the ground were saying that there were actually a lot of concerns. So the body cameras that the Ferguson police are wearing now were donated, but nobody has been able to figure out, or none of the organizers that we spoke with knew who donated those cameras. They just had them all of a sudden, and the footage is being monitored in-house. So that footage is being monitored by the police. Yeah. They're the only ones who get to see what's going on the body cameras.
Exactly. And release them and edit it.
And then, so that really comes back to the question of, are the cameras really there for the protection of the citizens, or are they one more tactic to increase police power?
Yeah, absolutely. I is going to have to wrap up here in a minute. I was wondering if we could talk about what's going to happen next. There's still civil disobedience happening, people trying to block off highways, people still doing sittings, teachings, etc. But there is another mass mobilization that's coming up.
Yeah, so sort of what's coming up next is there's been this emphasis that Ferguson is LA, is Chicago, is New York, etc. And so the next thing coming up is that on September 22nd, there's been a call put out to converge on Ohio.
Okay.
Because, just very briefly, John Crawford III was in Walmart. And and Ohio is an open carry state. And so he had a BB gun, and someone called in that he was threatening people, which ended up actually not being the case, but he was shot while his back was turned by police for leaning against a shelf, holding a BB gun, and chatting with his fiance on the phone. And the grand jury in a Walmart where they sell BB guns.
Where they sell BB guns, yeah.
And so the grand jury is convening actually on September 22nd, and folks are planning a march from the Walmart to the courthouse in Dayton, Ohio, I believe, and a camp out as long as it takes until the grand jury decision comes down. So that's the next thing happening. Calls going out for that, for folks to travel to Ohio. And then in October, from October 9th to 13th, Hands Up United, Organization for Black Struggle, are having a mass mobilization for folks to converge again on Ferguson. There'll be teach-ins, days of training, and then actions that are going to be planned. So they want folks to travel again to Ferguson in October.
Is there going to be a ride locally that's being organized?
We're going to see who wants to get involved in planning that.
If folks that are listening are interested in maybe lending a hand or being part, is there a way that they can contact you guys?
I've actually still been using the Black Lives Matter Facebook event, mm-hmm. Even though it's been passed.
Yeah, so it's I've Black Lives Matter Oregon.
Black Lives Matter Ride to Ferguson
from Oregon and Washington.
Yeah.
On Facebook.
Mm-hmm. On Facebook, so that's kind of a wordy mm-hmm. event name.
Yeah.
But I've been updating folks on that, mm-hmm. On what's coming out from national mm-hmm. calls, things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's one way to do that.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I want to thank you both, Stephen Gilliam and Sarah Dudley, for being on Bread and Roses and reporting for us. Thank you so much. Thank you, all of you, for tuning into Bread and Roses. We are a collective of women-identified radio activists, and we would love for you to join our collective. Please contact Ani Hain. She is KBOO's volunteer manager. Her email is volunteer@kboo.org. You can also find us on the web, kboo.fm/Bread and Roses, and Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses. That's where you can find us. Have a wonderful week, everyone. And we're going to leave you with J. Cole. This is Be Free, a tribute to Michael Brown. Have a great evening.
Take no x-ray to see right through my smile. I know I'll be on the go. And it ain't no drink out there that can numb my soul. Oh no. And all we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is break the chains off, man. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is break the chains off me. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is be free. Can you tell me why? Every time I step outside, I see my niggas die.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Tiny Home Celebration and Fundraiser on Sunday, September 14th from 2 to 8 p.m. This celebration features a tiny home tour, opportunities to learn about tiny house living from designers, builders, and residents, a barbecue, including vegan options, and various games and entertainment. Confirmed speakers include Darren Williams, founder of ShelterWise, Dave Carboneau, co-founder of TechDwell, and tiny home movement advocate Eli Spevic. The Tiny Home Celebration and Fundraiser is at Overlook Park, located at 1301 North Fremont Street in Portland. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Tiny Home Celebration and Fundraiser on Sunday, September 14th.